Welcome to the Assembly of Silence Radio Hour. This audio program has been carefully packed to the legal limit with a weekly allowance of non-governmentally approved deep thoughts per square minute of podcast. And now, here are your hosts, Judah and Noah.
Is it a bad idea to be eating while recording a podcast? That's what
I want. I think you just got to take care of yourself.
Well, am I taking care of our audience, though?
We'll never know.
Yeah, because no one ever talks to us.
No one says a word.
We're not hearing a peep. People keep listening, but no one says shit.
I know.
What's up with you people?
I look forward to the first email we ever get.
We're going to send a special prize to whoever sends us that first email.
What could that be?
I don't know, but we're going to find something.
Maybe we'll have him on as a guest.
It's going too far. We need more information before we can go there.
That's true. Who would that person be?
Anyway, while I'm eating this delicious keto-friendly bread thing that you just made and generously offered, why don't you talk a little bit about this massive tome that you're reading?
Oh, my. Well, I am reading currently the Mahabharata, the translation by Ramesh Menon, which is the Mahabharata is one of, it's the second of three epics from India. And the Mahabharata is the great war, the war to end all wars, the war between cousins, the Kauravas and the Pandavas. And
so that's the war that's referred to in the Bhagavad Gita.
Yes, exactly. In fact, the Bhagavad Gita is built into the Mahabharata.
Oh.
Yeah.
So how many war to end all wars have we had now?
I'm not quite sure. I don't know. Probably quite a few. But this one takes place right at the turning from the Dwapara Yuga into the Kali Yuga. So we literally cross into the Kali Yuga during this war. And it's the war to cleanse the earth of as much evil as possible and the domination of the Kshatriyas, which were like the kingly fighting caste of India at that time. And it's a battle beyond epic proportions to that Krishna comes as the incarnation of Vishnu, which is when Vishnu incarnates, it's to clean house for the most part. And that's
in order to maintain.
Exactly.
Right.
So Krishna and his cousin Arjuna, they are of the Pandavas. And the Pandavas were exiled from their kingdom for 13 years. 12 of those years were just in the jungles, and the final year they had to go incognito. They couldn't be discovered, for if they were, they would be exiled another dozen years. And so at the end of that exile, Yudhishthira, who's the oldest of the Pandava brothers, which is there's Yudhishthira, there's Bhima, who's the son of the wind, all the Pandava brothers, so which includes Arjuna as well.
And there's five, is that right?
Yep, Sahadeva and, Nakula. So you have Yudhishthira, the oldest, who's the king-to-be. You have Bhima, Arjuna, Sahadeva, and Nakula. Those are
so
the five
Arjuna's
Pandavas.
The middle child.
Who's the middle? Arjuna, yeah. Mm-hmm. Arjuna's the middle. And they're all sons of gods, so they're what are called Devaputras. And so they're all the sons of different gods. And they are fighting their cousins, the Kauravas. So the Pandavas are on the side of Dharma, and Krishna is with them. Mm-hmm. And the Kauravas are adharma, and they have been what's called the Kuru line, and they are the first in this lineage. It's the most noble house ever in existence, and they are the first to bring evil into it, to go the path of adharma.
They were said to be ruled by a blind king.
Yes, Dhritarashtra. Yes. Mm-hmm. Or Dhritarashtra. And so he is the blind king, and his brother was Pandu. And Pandu actually conquered most of the region for his brother. and then he dies due to a curse that he has. And his brother, Dhritarashtra, who's the blind king, instead of treating his brother's sons as his own sons, turns on them in jealousy. But he has 100 sons, the oldest being Duryodhana. And Duryodhana, all these children were born in an evil way. The mother, at the time of giving her birth, she aborted. And it wasn't a fully formed fetus. And a rishi comes and separates all the flesh into 100 pieces and puts them in clay pots and casts this spell. And all the children, all the sons of this king, 100 of them, are born. And the oldest, Duryodhana, when he was born, he was the biggest, and he had fangs for teeth. And all these omens came out, like jackals in the night and vultures and like all these evil omens, raining blood, raining flesh, happen. And the king's brother, Vidura, who is a sage, is a wise one, says, you know, this is an evil omen. And the king says, what can I do to stop this? And he says, the very thing you won't, that is, kill your son now before he grows, because Duryodhana is the incarnation of evil. And Duryodhana is the one who has pushed for this war. He is his ego, his greed, his hatred and jealousy of his cousins is what drives this war. And he's been given 100 chances, been warned 100 times by like the wise ones in his kingdom, such as his father, his father's brothers, and his guru, and he won't listen.
It's interesting that on the one hand we have these 5 sons, right?
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, 100 of a blind king.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Who was not only physically blind, but spiritually blind. He was blinded by filial love.
Right.
And chose the path of a dharma or non-truth.
Right.
Over truth because of his love for his son.
Which is essentially a materialist point of view.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, that particular blood of my blood
right.
is more important than any eternal truth.
Right.
Right.
Right. Even with Krishna on their side. And everybody, they all seem to know who Krishna is. Everyone knows that he's Vishnu incarnate. They know he's an avatar. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's spoken over and over. The blue one is the dark one. The blue one, he's an avatar. They all know he's Vishnu incarnate. And he's still, like, they can't.
Well, the way I heard the story, and I haven't read the whole epic, so I don't know if this is true, but I heard that Krishna gave both sides a choice as to what powers they might choose to have on their side in this great conflict.
Yes.
And that the blind king and his sons chose Krishna's material powers.
Right.
His armies and what have you, and weapons. Whereas the, what are they called? The
Pandavas.
Pandavas, they chose Krishna's spiritual guidance.
Right.
Right.
So as they came out of exile, they sent messengers, the Pandavas sent messengers to the Kauravas to say, please give us our rightful kingdom back, which is this place called Indrastapur. As the war is getting like closer to being announced, Duryodhana, the evil prince, is sent to go ask for Krishna's help in the war. And Arjuna goes at the same time from their two different places. The rule was is that whoever gets to a king first and asks for his help, that king has to honor that request. Mm. So Duryodhana tries to get to Krishna before Arjuna does. And he does, but Krishna is asleep. And they're both led into his chamber, and Arjuna is at the foot of the bed, and Duryodhana is at the side, kind of off in a corner. And when Krishna awakes, even though Duryodhana was there first, the first one he sees is Arjuna. And so he says, well, the first one I saw was Arjuna, but I'll honor you too, Duryodhana, if you say you were first. So I'll give you a choice. You can have, Duryodhana, you can have either my army or you can have me on your side and I won't fight. Hmm. And Duryodhana just laughs and he says, well, that's obvious. I'll take your army. And Arjuna's like, thank you, because all I want is Krishna.
Brilliant.
Yeah. And
it's amazing how the stories speak the truth. You know, without having to like spell it out in technical terms or something like that. It's like so naturally woven into the narrative of the story.
It's incredible. It's an amazing story of, you know, and I read the Ramayana before this one.
So. Incredible. I was saying before we started recording how you love these long texts that, you know, require an incredible amount of dedication in order to get all the way through.
Mm.
I'm more like, you know, give me the Reader's Digest, you know, give me some kind of a summary thing.
No. I had to. And that was by Ramesh Menon as well. So if anybody has an interest in the Mahabharata or the Ramayana, and then there's another one, and I think it's called Bhargata Parva. And
that's the third epic.
But Ramesh Menon writes with the most, oh, it's beautiful, it's poetic. It's scholarly yet written poetically, so it's not dry. But when I read these from him, I feel immediately in the story. Like I'm
in
it.
Is he a contemporary translator?
Yeah. Like I think he put out the Ramayana in like 2005, maybe. So, but, you know, the Ramayana, that goes back, you know, the time frame for that is over a million years ago, supposedly.
Oh, so that was one of the things, what you just said struck me as being interesting, because if we're transitioning from, what is the previous?
Dwapara into the Kali.
Yeah.
Right.
So the cleansing of the evil obviously didn't work. I mean, the Kali Yuga is a time of darkness, right?
Right. It was to do as much as they could to prepare for.
Otherwise, it would be a lot worse.
Exactly. Otherwise, it would be the utter ruin of humanity. Yeah.
So what is the characteristic of, what is the previous Yuga?
Dwapara.
So how would you characterize that?
The Dwapara was like a Yuga of action, I think, is how they call it. So.
And is that after the Sat Yuga?
That is the third Yuga. The Sat or the Krita Yuga, which is the golden age, which is an age of truth. And then there is the Treta Yuga, and I can't remember the exact... I was just looking at this today, and I can't remember the exact characteristic theme for that yuga.
You can send it to me, and I'll insert it into the audio here.
Oh, that'd be awesome. Yeah, that'd be great, because it's really cool. And I have it. I know where I can find it.
Okay, here we have the characteristics of each yuga according to Wikipedia. The Satya Yuga is the first and best yuga, the age of truth and perfection. This yuga has 0% of crime and 100% of kindness. It's also referred to as the Krita Yuga, so named because there was but one religion, and all men were saintly, therefore they were not required to perform religious ceremonies. Humans were gigantic, powerfully built, honest, youthful, vigorous, erudite, and virtuous. The Vedas were one. All mankind could attain to supreme blessedness. There was no agriculture or mining, as the earth yielded those riches on its own. So it's kind of a Garden of Eden situation. Weather was pleasant and everyone was happy. There were no religious sects. There was no disease, decrepitude, or fear of anything. And then we have the Treta Yuga. It's considered to be the second yuga in order. However, Treta means the third. In this age, virtue diminishes slightly. Many emperors rise to dominance and conquer the world. Wars become frequent and weather begins to change to extremities. Oceans and deserts are formed. So I guess even back then we had radical climate change. People become slightly diminished compared to their predecessors. Agriculture, labor, and mining becomes existent. And then we have Dvapara Yuga. It's considered to be the third yuga in order. Dvapara means two-part, or after two. In this age, people become tainted with tamasic qualities, which I believe tamas is ignorance. and they are not as strong as their ancestors. Diseases become rampant. Humans are discontent and fight each other. Vedas are divided into four parts. People still possess characteristics of youth in old age. Average lifespan of humans is around a few centuries. And then the Kali Yuga, the final age. It is the age of darkness and ignorance. People become sinners and lack virtue. They become slaves to their passions. Society falls into disuse. And people become liars and hypocrites. Knowledge is lost and scriptures are diminished. Humans eat forbidden and dirty food. The environment is polluted, water and food become scarce. Wealth is heavily diminished. Families become non-existent. By the end of Kali Yuga, the average lifespan of humans will be as low as 70 years. It also says here that the actual duration of yugas is still controversial, but maybe that controversy is just a characteristic of the Kali Yuga. Back to the regularly scheduled episode.
And then the Dwapara was like a yuga of action. It was like where the Kshatriyas were like the dominant force, and these were like the kingly priests. They're not kingly, but yeah, they were kingly, devotional. They had gurus, and they were warriors. So to die in battle was the greatest honor,
right?
To achieve swarga or heaven.
It's kind of like Rome, like that kind of militaristic, materialistic-oriented society.
Yeah, very spiritually oriented because
right. A
lot of the weapons that they're working with, what's really fascinating if you read the Ramayana and you read the Mahabharata, but the weapons that they work with are what they call astras. And they're a lot of times they're mantra-initiated. So there's mantras to create these weapons and fire off these weapons. So you have to have a spiritual understanding. And in fact, in the Ramayana, the person who gives Rama all of his weaponry is the guru, Aswamedha, who is a rishi. He's like a fully enlightened. He's mastered every single mantra-oriented weapon there is that exists. But he was born a Kshatriya, and his jealousy and hatred for a rishi set him on this path of great spiritual study, of great what's called tapasya. And
Who's a rishi again?
A rishi is like a seer. They can see through all time, past, present, future. So these are like the sadhus or the holy men.
So he had a hatred for...
for this particular spiritual
man. For a particular one.
Yeah. Oh. Brahma's... I think he was... I can't remember if it was Brahma's son...
because he revealed something they didn't want to see?
Yeah, pretty much. It was like there was a jealousy there of, and I can't remember what sparked it.
Well, you could say that in general that a devoted materialist would have a hatred for a devoted spiritualist. Mm,
you could. But then in order to conquer this particular rishi, he does all this spiritual work and keeps battling and he keeps going for all this spiritual work to the point where he finally gets to the point where he's mastered everything and he realizes that it's not that he comes to that full self-realization and he gives up the battle.
Huh.
Because now he sees. But he's gone through this
mass. What a path to enlightenment.
Yeah, and it's like thousands of years, right? So it's like thousands of years of this activity. And he masters every single weapon there is. And as a wise man now, as like the head spiritual force of Rama's,
military
line, the Ishvakus is their name, he gifts Rama all this weaponry and teaches him all the mantras to use it. And yeah, so it's really this.
That's a fascinating, I mean, it seems like these characters who are given lifespans of thousands of years, you can think of them as being developments within society.
Right.
That there's a certain kind of type of soul that's working its karma out and has a developmental process going on within society. And you can see that within the military people and, more martial arts, like there are a lot of people within the martial arts who have come exactly to that conclusion. Mm-hmm. You know, they go mm-hmm. through this rigorous training and they learn how to whoop ass big time. Mm-hmm. And then they get to this point where they're just like, I'm going to just hand over my weapons and preach peace and just mm-hmm. practice loving kindness. And, you know, it's a fascinating thing to observe that there's so many different pathways. If you decide that you're going to really take things as deeply as possible, there are many, many avenues to the truth.
Right. Exactly.
Exactly. But far fewer avenues to the truth than there are to falsehood, sadly.
Exactly. Oh, my God, yes. You know, one of the recurring themes of both of these epics, the Ramayana is the Adi Parva, which is the first epic ever. It's the first epic ever written. And then the Mahabharata is the second. But
ever written in the history of the world?
Yeah, as far as I'm aware. Huh. Yeah, that's what they say about it. They say they're like, I mean, to put it in like modern terms, they're like spiritual transmissions. That even just by reading it, you're getting this deep imprinting of spiritual teaching. And I mean, you read these and it's profound spiritual truths, I mean, from the beginning to the end.
And I'll bet you it's even more profound if you read it in Sanskrit.
Yeah, exactly.
Because apparently, I mean, from what the little I know about Sanskrit, it is one of the most beautifully constructed languages ever.
Right.
So elegant and like where the parts are just, everything relates. Mm-hmm. And there's just basically like an embedded poetry to the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the tones and the, yeah, it's they're amazing. But one of the recurring themes here that I think has really gotten me through the last few weeks of my life.
Bringing things back to practical considerations here.
Yeah, mm-hmm. is the power of accepting and seeing the fate and destiny of life.
Yeah. Right.
So that no matter what is happening, realizing that that's what's meant to happen and that there's some sort of fate or destiny behind it.
Right.
And you may not be able to see it, and it may seem like you're being wronged. It may seem like the world is out to get you mm-hmm. Or you're cursed. But the reality is we don't know what's being put in motion through this, and all we can do is navigate it, or what I am finding I can do is navigate it with the greatest grace I possibly can mm-hmm. and seeing it for what it is, which is life unfolding and not getting caught up in the why is this happening or woe is me,
right.
but really hold my neutrality and look and go, wow, this is what's unfolding and it's really sad and devastating, and yet at the same time I have to trust this.
Yeah, and that something will be at the very least learned from it.
Right.
So it does seem a direct relation between suffering and wisdom.
Yes, exactly.
So we go through these difficulties, and if we're paying attention and we don't blame, we don't play the victim,
right.
we come out with a greater richness in our own understanding.
Exactly.
You know, and state of being.
Exactly. They say, throughout both of them, they say over and over again, oh, those who suffer are truly blessed because they become wise.
Right. Yeah, it seems like that is basically the crucible of the path.
Yeah. Yep.
It's interesting to note that so many spiritual hucksters promise bliss.
Right.
And freedom from stress and pain.
Right.
If only you'll practice this particular set of, seems like probably not. That's actually probably a pretty good warning sign.
Yeah.
Red flags when all of a sudden it's all like,
yeah,
all your problems will be solved.
Right. Transcending any kind of challenges or whatnot. And not saying that, you know, life, you know, the easy path doesn't really, that's not for the ones who want growth in life.
Well, they say, you know, easy now, hard later. Hard now, easy later.
Easy later, exactly, exactly. And I just it's not like I want challenge all the time. I want some, like, times of ease and times of, you know, grace and flow. But then there's these times of challenge that help me keep my sword sharp.
Yeah.
Where it keeps my skills intact.
And I think that it, without
homed, that, I should say,
without that sense of having progression in one's life, it's very difficult to truly feel at ease.
Right.
Because life is always moving on.
Right.
And we have to continue to move with it in one way or another. It seems to me that fundamentally the true place of rest is within the spiritual domain, because there really is no material resting zone. You know, ultimately it's the eternal that is the ground of being. And so that's where we find peace.
Yeah.
You know, the physical world is never really restful. It's constantly churning. You know, everything is moving and vibrating all the time.
Right.
So it seems that the spiritual development is necessary in order to be able to handle the material existence without it ruining you.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's that.
And in some ways, the blind king and his sons are a representation of the material world ruining someone. And it's interesting that it's the more populated kind of side of the family.
Yeah.
Because it's all one big family, and that's Arjuna's dilemma, right?
Is right.
That he doesn't want to fight his cousins and his all these people he's come to love.
His cousins, his grandfather.
Right.
His uncle. You know, his guru.
Right. That's interesting guru. And ironic that the guru also is on that other side.
And they all, and the grandfather and the guru both know that it's a hopeless battle against Arjuna because he has Krishna,
right?
And that all the Pandavas are Devaputras, they're sons of gods.
So, well, you could say that in a certain sense that's a representation of the ascendancy of the eternal, irrespective of the material's protestations. You know, so all of this noise and destruction and terror can churn on for as long as it possibly can, but eventually it will peter out in the face of the eternal, which is the spiritual domain.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the connectivity there. It's like the it's interesting because, of course, Vishnu is the continuity.
Sustainer, right?
Right?
Yeah.
And then Shiva is the creator, destroyer.
Brahma is the creator. Vishnu is like the sustainer, and Shiva is like the destroyer.
I've thought of it like Brahma is the dreamer within which the battle between Shiva and Vishnu occurs, and that Shiva is kind of like chaos, because chaos has both a destructive and constructive process to it.
Sure.
And Vishnu is like order,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's that kind of dialectic between the basic, you know, yin-yang type of thing. So it's all occurring within Brahma, because that's like the mind of God.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I've thought of that. But I know that like the development of the Hindu Trinity is something that changed a lot over the course of time.
Right.
And it took a while for them to distill it to those three gods as being the ones of which all others are manifestation.
Right. Is my understanding that Brahma was born out of a lotus that sprouted from the navel of Vishnu.
See, that's bizarre.
Right? So Vishnu, resting on the seas, I believe, and that's a particular... He has different names for different aspects of himself, but and I can't remember the name of this one, but he's resting on the seas and on the sea of water, and out of his navel sprouts a lotus flower, and from that lotus flower comes Brahma.
So an interesting thing comes into play there, because you could think of the concept of continuity as being the foundation of any existence.
Mm-hmm.
And so it would precede anything, even the mind within which this world is dreaming. So you could make the case that like there is a Vishnu underlayment upon which Brahma then rests his dreaming head.
Mm-hmm.
And then within that mind, the dynamic of Vishnu and Shiva play itself out.
Right.
And that Shiva is kind of the little fluctuations on the surface of what is fundamentally a deep wellspring of continuity.
Mm-hmm.
Because the changes are, you know, when we think about all the things that are happening in our lives, right, and they seem so momentous and intense and overwhelming and important. Mm-hmm. And then we kind of consider that life is this little thing on the surface of one tiny planet in a single solar system in a galaxy of billions of stars and apparently a bunch of other galaxies. And it's sort of like, oh, those changes happening there are super significant, are they? It's like, no, that's just happening on a little surface and there's a bunch of other big changes happening. But they're also kind of basically just surface phenomena right. in the continuity if you look at the whole thing in kind of a general sense. So what the hell are we talking about?
So, I mean, you're going somewhere really interesting. And one of the things I think of is the Hindu concept of time, which I'm researching and I'm still trying to grasp all the numbers. But the way it looks is something like a day and a night of Brahma is something like 4 point some odd trillion years, I believe.
Trillion
years is one day and one night to Brahma. I believe. Don't quote me on this, everybody, but if you want to look up the Hindu concept of time, you'll see. But there's a lot to break down because you have what a day and a night is to Brahma, and it's so many divine years, and a divine year is 12,000 or a divine year is 365 human years.
It's also interesting to note that they're putting the day in terms of Brahma. So Brahma right. is playing this role of sort of like universal timekeeper in a certain sense.
Right. And so when Brahma opens his eyes and it's day, there's existence. And then when that day comes to an end, 4 point some odd trillion years, he closes his eyes and everything dissolves. And then when he opens his eyes again, big bang, you have another birth of a universe.
So how long does he close his eyes for? What's going on when he closes his eyes?
That's the void.
So
that's the void.
There's no time in the void.
Exactly.
So it doesn't matter.
Right. And I don't, you know, it's a day of, I guess maybe a full day and a full night, the 4 point some odd trillion years, whatever is happening during that sleep time, I don't know. That seems like, from what I can understand, that's the void. When he sleeps, all of creation dissolves. And so now you're back into the void, the right. black, right? The nothingness. And then when he opens his eyes again, you have the big bang and you have creation come into existence. And then within that day, there's multiple other sorts of really long spans of time, like hundreds of millions of years, that, you know, there's a time frames that are ruled by specific manus.
What's a manu?
Manu is the being who will bring the next race of humans into existence.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So, and there's a particular manu for so many hundreds of millions of years.
And that's envisioned as like a god or something?
Yeah, he's just kind of, or is there a biological archetype, almost like the archetype of...
Is there a biological component to that?
I believe so,
yeah. Is it more like an energetic type of thing?
Well, it's not like a physical form, but it is what brings the next race of humans onto the planet.
So that it's like an energetic imprint, yeah. Sort of kind of pattern.
Yeah. So it's well, super...
We got to revisit that idea a little bit. The idea of Brahma opening and closing his eyes and that the universe experiences multiple kind of big bangs on that basis, that to me I find kind of instinctually more satisfying than the idea that we're in a single expanding universe that will expand forever. Like that just seems like nothing really works like that. What in the cosmos could possibly expand forever?
Right.
That's been something that's been troubling me lately because there's so much pinned on that right now. You know, the idea that's running right now is that we're in this expanding universe that's not only expanding, but it's expanding at an accelerating rate.
Right.
It gets faster and faster. And it's like, okay, realistically speaking, is that actually something that could continue indefinitely? Seems unlikely.
It does seem unlikely. And, you know, it gives me greater satisfaction, too, because the cosmology behind it, there's meaning. There's, like, real depth of meaning to this, whereas, you know, shit just happened and boom, you know.
Well,
you
it
know.
Ties it to our existence.
Yeah.
You know, because we recognize these archetypes in our own living.
Yes.
And that's the beauty of the Hindu concept of all fundamental forces, which is kind of what the gods are manifestations of these three primary forces.
Right.
And there's something truly beautiful about that. And I wouldn't be surprised if when science finally gets its shit together, if it does, that they don't discover that we're talking about three fundamental primary forces.
Right.
But, you know, I wonder when Brahma starts to close his eyes, you know, it's probably not like they're shut.
Right.
So there is, I would imagine, a transition between day and night. Mm-hmm. And what does that look like in the universe?
Possibly like a Kali Yuga.
Well, it may be that there's a, it might be a Kali Yuga.
Right.
Right. So it could be obviously a time of darkness is what it's being characterized as. Mm-hmm. So it would be closing down, sort of like the light dimming, right? Mm-hmm. Universally speaking, would we see a reversal of this expansion? If the opening of the eye is a big bang and things are expanding, are we now talking about a period of contraction, of universal contraction?
It seems like that would be the case.
Right.
Right.
You know, from the scientific point of view, the question then becomes, you know, at some point or another, that would become observable in the sense that the universe would no longer be expanding. Mm. And it would probably take a while before we would get that message because supposedly we're talking about evidence from the fringes of the universe that come in as light information. So when the envelope of the entire universe shifts direction, it would probably the message would probably arrive late in the game. Mm-hmm. It would probably appear as if things were still expanding for quite some time if there was a turnaround, because those light messages wouldn't shift until whatever number of billion of years passes of the distance between us and them, light years.
Right, and who's to say we're going to receive it while we're still here, right?
Seems unlikely.
It does. And so expansion and contraction is one of the great universal themes, isn't it? Right?
No doubt.
It is, you know, breath in, breath out, food in, food out. Everything goes from periphery to center and center back to periphery, or center to periphery. Mm-hmm. That's what I want to say, from center to periphery and back from periphery to center.
You could say that basically that is the pattern with consciousness as well. Consciousness is a center, and I would say that consciousness is the thing which organizes things around a center, and that's because consciousness perceives things as occurring from a center. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we draw things in, or we experience things coming in, and then we issue forth expressions,
right?
Radiation.
Or we look out and then we can turn our gaze back in.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We can look out into the world and project out, and then we have the opportunity and the choice available to us to be able to turn our gaze back in.
Well, that's the funny thing about being in a body, is that you have the out there experience, which can really fundamentally be applied to both the body itself and the environment within which the body is existing. Mm-hmm. Because the sense of being a conscious thing is something that emanates through the body. The senses are mediators with the environment. So you could think of consciousness as being some sort of a center into which the senses are plugged, right? Mm-hmm. And so the immediate environment of consciousness is the body.
Yeah.
So you can think of the body as being the first layer of what's out there.
Yes.
From the perspective of consciousness. Yeah. And then from the perspective of the body, which the consciousness is experiencing, you then have the environment that the body is inside of, which is another out there. It's another layer out there, right? Mm-hmm. So on a certain level, when you're saying, I'm looking inward, if you're looking inward to your body, from my point of view, that's still outward from your consciousness, right? But looking inward in the consciousness, you know, noticing what occurs within your mind, right? Mm-hmm. Noticing what occurs within the heart mind, really.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So, you know, the heart aspect is kind of a more body-oriented set of messages that consciousness receives. It's rooted in the physical, right? The nexus of those two things formulates experience, essentially, the thinking, feeling. And then the ability to observe what those things are is a more interiority than whatever gastrointestinal experiences you're currently having or any other types of bodily function, pain, sensation, what have you. And then even behind that, I think there's this other level of, you know, what might be called like pure consciousness. So in some level, maybe the Steiner category of soul is what we're talking about when you're observing your own heart, mind, thought pattern.
Thought, feelings, and will impulses.
Right.
Yeah.
And then behind that is this kind of the I, the root of consciousness, just
the center point.
Yeah, it's the being,
yeah,
the isness, I guess, is what the Buddhists would say, right?
We could also call it the self, with a capital L.
Yeah, I guess so. S. You know, that's one of the things that – it's another word that gets used in a variety of different ways. Yeah. So some people say, oh, selfish, and that might be the individual kind of thinking heart. So people get confused, I think, with the word self. It's
right.
One of the terminological issues that, you know, it's – but yeah.
So when you read the Upanishads, what they talk about is as the self is always in the heart, repeatedly through the Upanishads and the Vedas. The self is found in the heart. And they say it's the smallest atom in the world and the greatest aspect of the universe, all found in the heart.
That is
the self.
That's exactly what the Taoists say too.
Yeah.
They say, you know, smaller than a mustard seed, something like that, which is, of course, a biblical comparison as well.
Yeah.
And greater than anything else.
Yeah. Well, if you want to get a real idea of, like, a lot of Christ's parables, go read the Upanishads. There are places within there where, I mean, these are the Psalms, these are some of the deeper biblical teachings, especially if Christ's teachings are in the Upanishads. Like, you see the origin of this teaching. At least I did. Like, when I'm reading through it, and I've been listening to it on audio as well, and over again, I'm like, wow, this is like a parable. This is Christ's teachings here.
Well, you know, there's three possible ways of looking at that, at least. You know, one would be that there are some people who think that Christ went east.
Yes.
And, so, you know, because there's this sort
the
of...
The missing years.
Yeah, the missing years, exactly.
Yes.
So that's one possible theory. The other would be this kind of like that the Christ story and so many of these great spiritual traditions are basically aggregations of a variety of world stories that had been traveling around. And so ancient wisdom traditions had been going on for a long time, many different threads from many different parts of the world. They would be updated periodically for new languages, new civilizations. They would want to excise certain portions, you know, like, so there was this kind of editing process happening. And because it was a pool of ideas circulating, there would be a commonality.
Right.
But the third possibility is that anyone who thinks seriously about these things would come up with the same basic ideas, irrespective of whether they were in contact with each other.
Universal because, human experience.
And because the eternal is a unity, and if you tap into that unity, you're going to get the same message.
Exactly. It is an overarching underlying truth, right? Truth is one, paths are many, right? And so it is the fabric of the cosmos. And if you tune into that, you get the same teachings everywhere.
Amen.
You know, and that's the gift of it.
So. Yes. But the only thing that I would emphasize at this point, which would be, of course, characteristic of me, is that if we think that we have gotten that message, we are tempting the fates.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a very, very tricky thing. And it's really clear when you read something and it resonates very strongly that there's real wisdom there, that someone has managed to capture essence, you know? But we do have to be very careful with the idea that somehow or another now we've got it.
Right.
And certainly when it comes to our own experiences, deriving some kind of a formula from them, it's so easy to go wrong. I speak from experience on
yeah,
that one.
Yeah, I always think, you know, once I think I got it, I lost it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's the humility of the spiritual path of just realizing I know nothing and I have fleeting glimpses and it's all fate and destiny and I can just, all I can do is just pray for grace.
All right. Well,
that was good. That was good.
Okay, you know, maybe there's something to recording without the ear goggles on.
That's true. Not hearing kinda, ourselves.
Yeah, you get back into this space instead of being in this weird...
Yeah. Like, yeah.
So hopefully it sounds good. I guess we'll find out.
We'll figure... We'll I have to imagine it does. It's not like it's going to sound any different just because we were wearing these.
Well, yeah, I guess we might have done a few things differently, but that would probably be the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because, yeah, it seems like we live in a world where people are constantly monitoring everything that they're doing.
Right.
And that's not really natural, is it?
No.
It seems like most creatures are not constantly going, should I do that? What, you know, how was that?
Did I sound
right
when I said that? Right? So, yeah, that's...
So we just went au naturel. I felt like a little naked at first
without
the ear goggles on, yeah.
I felt kind of normal.
Yeah, because you usually wear earbuds.
I wear the earbuds. Yeah, I don't have the big... Yeah.
Yeah, but I forgot my headphones today.
Good thing.
So it's a good thing.
Did.
Yeah. A great blessing. Okay. That was good.
That was good.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a good one.
That was a good one. There won't be another one like that. But there'll be another one that's not like that.
That's true. I just hope we didn't just shoot it all right there.
We're going to find out right now. So stay tuned for the next episode.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard, throw us a bone by subscribing to this channel, visiting our social media pages, and hitting the various like, love, and clap buttons. We welcome all comments, criticisms, and random thoughts. Our email is silentassembly@protonmail.com. And if you want to be an angel, we have a Patreon page at patreon.com/silentassembly. We look forward to serving you again soon. In the meantime, remember, turn that thing over a few times before you pick it up and take it home.